Hey, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 8th, 2009, and this is show number 194. Well, you know what? I have no idea what time it is. I hate time changes, but I hate it even more that the United States now moves early and messes it up for the rest of the world. I guess if you live in a little bubble or maybe only talk to people you meet in meet space, this might not be such a problem. But now my friends are sprinkled all around the world. Do you realize what havoc is this creating? So every week I do chit-chat across the pond with Bart at 10 o'clock in the morning my time, which is 6 p.m. his time. See, he's at GMT 0 and I'm at GMT minus 8. It's all good. But now for two stinking stupid little weeks, we have to figure out how to do it at 11 my time, so it's at 6 his time, or maybe we should do it at 5 o'clock his time, which is still 10 o'clock my time, or maybe we should split the difference and do it at 5:30 his time and 10:30 my time for 2 weeks. Then we go back normal, and then we do it again for 2 weeks, and then we go back normal again. Imagine the anguish Rose and I had today trying to figure out what time it will be in Tasmania, Australia, when I record the live show. I told her it's easy. See, Australia stays still and Europe stays still. The United States slides 1 hour closer to Bart, so that must mean we move 1 hour farther away from Australia, right? She wrote back, "My head hurts." I couldn't agree more. Okay, here's the really bad part. I convinced her that since I'm an hour farther away, that would make it an hour earlier for her. Now, that's a problem because she works nights, and that would actually mean she'd have to wake up earlier to hear the show live. I was wrong. Since I'm an hour farther away from her, it actually means it's an hour later, I think. Oh, man, I have no idea. Whose idea was this anyway? This is so lame. Well, let's talk about something fun, shall we? I went on a business trip this week to Tucson, and I had the great pleasure of meeting up with the Mac mommy, Melissa. She and her son, who she calls LD, so she can track him. Actually, she calls him Pound LD when she tweets, so she can track her tweets and record what she's written about him as he grows up. Anyway, Melissa joined me for a couple hours one evening, and we just sat and geeked out. It was so much fun. She's as delightful a person as I imagine. She's beautiful and articulate and entertaining and self-deprecating. I confessed to her that I don't actually like children all that much, but I adored LD. He is so cute. Get this, the minute he sat down, now let's remember, he's not even three yet. He reaches out for my iPhone and says, "iPod." Of course I let him play with it. I couldn't help myself. He was very careful, and he mostly enjoyed flipping it 90 degrees to watch whatever was on screen when he rotated it. Well, one worry I have about telling all of you this is that you're going to want to meet up too someday. Well, I worry kind of as a woman doing that in general, you know, going to meet some stranger. I know Melissa really well, and I was pretty sure meeting a woman in a public place, I'd be okay. But please don't take offense if I ever say no to you, okay? Promise? It's come up before, and I hate to disappoint people, and sometimes people are hurt. But, you know, when you're an international superstar and all like I am, not. But anyway, don't be sad if it doesn't work out. Well, I did a really short recording with Melissa and LD, so you guys could join in and hear us just a little bit. Well, I am in Tucson, Arizona, not Tucson, California, with the Mac Mommy. How are you doing tonight, Melissa?
I'm doing pretty well now that I'm here with you.
This is so exciting. Like in meet space, really actual persons. And we have somebody with us. We have a special treat.
Hey, say hi.
It's Lucian.
Say hi.
The star of the show.
He is the star of the show. Say hi.
Hi.
That's awesome. So what did you say?
I'm
using iTalk Recorder on the iPhone because Rose told us about it. What did you say about Rose?
Rose is awesome.
Gotta love Rose. She's so cool. She's my hero.
We need to teach Lucian how to speak. What's
Strine?
Strine, is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, now we have the Rosetta Stone to teach him how to do it, right?
There we go.
So Melissa and I have got a meet up, right? So I tweet that I've got a, what did I put out? I put a picture of the sunset in Tucson, and you said...
The sunset, and then you responded back to somebody about Tucson. All I saw was Tucson, and you said even what restaurant you were at, and I didn't even read that far. I just saw Tucson, and got all excited. I was like, what? What?
Where are you?
What?
So
here?
She tweets me, so then, of course, I tweeted her back, and then she tweeted me back, and then I tweeted her back, and then she tweeted me back, and then I said, we're switching to email, so yeah. We tweeted each other that we were going to email.
And then we tweeted. Then we tweeted each other that we emailed each other to check your email.
Hey, but my favorite part is she says, "Okay, I'll meet you down in the, you know, by the fire pits at the hotel." But how's the Wi-Fi there? That was the next question.
So I'm bringing the laptop.
What do we got here? We've got the Cradle Point. We got a digital camera.
We got the gadgets. That was the first
two laptops. Okay, but my favorite thing is she brought her Huckleberry, which is a little reflector unit that allows you to
Periscope.
Periscope. Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a reflector that allows you to tape or
the video from the other side of the lid.
From the other side of the lid of your MacBook Pro. But what I love is she carried it in a Ziploc plastic box, which is a great way to carry it. So,
because I'm a mom, and that's how I roll.
That's how you roll. Well, I think we're going to say bye now. This is just very exciting for me. What do you think? Bye-bye.
Can you say bye-bye?
Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm telling you, seriously, I don't even like kids, but dang, Lucian was adorable. Had so much fun with him and Melissa. Anyway, I put a link, a photo in the show notes of Lucian and Melissa and I and how much fun we're having together so you can get a little peek into what we were doing. If you want to follow the Mac Mommy on Twitter, I promise you an engaging, interesting set of tweets coming out every day. She's at twitter.com/TheMacMommy. Well, good friend of the show, Len Charnoff, has contributed from time to time and given me great encouragement over the years as we've helped each other with online things. I introduced him to Animoto through the podcast, and he's gone crazy with that with pictures of his gorgeous cockatoos and parrots. Recently, I talked about a Dictomatic, and he found that to be of value, too. What he's done with these ideas from me and lots of other resources is create short video tutorials that show how these time-saving tips can help you out. He created a website called timesavingtutorials.com. I'm really impressed with the number of these he's done and the professionalism of his videos. He's using Camtasia Studio, which is a terrific Windows application, to create his videos. Go check them out. He's even got one on a Dictomatic where he talks about the NoSilicast as his resource. This week, Apple allowed Amazon to deliver a Kindle application in the App Store that lets you buy books at Amazon to read on your iPhone or iPod Touch. I put a link in the show notes to the application, and BJ sent in an audio recording about his first impressions of the Kindle application for the iPhone and iPod Touch. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Allison, and all the NoSilicast listeners. It's BJ from North Carolina chiming in on the latest cool ebook reader application for the iPhone and iPod Touch, the Amazon Kindle application. Yep, you heard me right. The Amazon Kindle iPhone app. I'm recording this on Thursday, one day after I figured out it was released due to the Twitter talk about it. I'm really, really happy with this so far. I've read several free samples on this new Kindle app so far, including a very long Star Trek book sample, and for the most part, I'm absolutely enjoying the experience. I almost wish I'd had this sort of experience earlier. I've had no experience with the Kindle, but this app makes me wish I had. You can switch to font size like on the Kindle. You can do just about everything you can do on the Kindle inside this app as far as I can see. And you can read free book samples. Unfortunately, the magazines and newspapers are not available as of right now on this particular application, which would have made this a must-have iPhone app, especially for someone like me who loves to read the newspaper. However, I don't plan on whining too much about it because I am really thinking about a Kindle now that I've had a few hours to play with this application. Honestly, the fun part about the Kindle app is the fact you can read all these books. Admittedly, I like that a lot. So, this is BJ from North Carolina signing off. Talk to you later, Allison.
Thanks, BJ. Man, I think you're really, really excited about that, aren't you? You know, I have a bad habit of downloading and installing applications on my iPhone right when I hear about them, and then I never launch them or play with them. You know, the instant I heard about the Kindle for iPhone, I was like, oh my gosh, that is so awesome. That is so totally cool. I totally got to do that. And I installed it, and then I moved on to the next shiny toy, and I forgot all about it. Based on what you said, I really do need to check it out. Well, you know how strict I am with the rule that I'll never try software that people tell me to try unless they explain to me what problem does it solve. However, I have one little loophole in that directive. A problem to be solved could be that you're bored or you don't have enough entertainment in your life. Well, Scott Jackson is on a message board I follow, and he found the most pure form of silliness you can add to your Mac. It's called Pop Rocks. Load this silly little thing up from codesorcery.net, and every time you launch a new application, the screen turns into a stage with this gold curtain behind it. Your new application is up on stage, and all the previously opened applications start jumping up and down with joy and clapping, going, yay! And there's music. It's the silliest thing. It's the goofiest thing ever. But you know what? It just makes me smile every time I do it. Go check it out. You won't run it long, probably, because it does get kind of annoying, but it's worth it for a couple of free giggles. Thanks, Scott. Well, Bruce sent in a review of the iFi Digital Traveler. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hi, Allison and fellow NosillaCast listeners. This is Bruce from North Texas, and this is a review of the iFi Traveler Secure Digital Photography Card from iFi. The company currently makes three different versions of secure digital cards, the Home, the Share, and the Explorer. They are in the process of expanding their product line to add the Share Video and rename and upgrade the Explorer to the Explorer Video. The Home allows you to wirelessly upload pictures to your computer. The Share adds the ability to upload pictures to a photo sharing site that they support through settings in your iFi account. The Share Video, a new model, is the same as the Share except with a capacity of 4 gigabytes. The Explorer expands on the capability of the Share by adding geotagging and a 1-year free subscription to 10,000 Wi-Fi hotspots. The Explorer Video upgrades the storage to 4 gigabytes. My version is the Explorer card. The first thing I noticed about my card was the adult-proof packaging. It comes in a hermetically sealed blister pack that takes strong scissors and tough hands or a blowtorch to get the packaging open. The scissors did the trick this time. The procedure I followed was on my iMac and my wife's MacBook. The card comes with its own secure digital USB adapter, which is quite small and holds the one card. I inserted the adapter into my USB hub and the card mounted just fine. I had to read the quick start guide to figure out where the software was hidden because it was not on the top level of the file structure on the card. I found the installer and the software installed without incident. The problems began when I tried to get the card to connect to my wireless network in my house. The wireless signal was not strong enough in my office for it to find and connect, even though my iMac could see the network with full signal strength. I did the same process on my wife's MacBook, and I got the card to see and connect to my network, but it would not connect to their server. The install software was on the card for both Mac and PC. When you put the card in your camera, it does not read the format, and you have to format the card. Once you do this, there is no way to get the software back on the card. I would recommend that you copy the card to a disk image or CD, just in case you want the software back. iFi does not have an image available that you can download to restore the card back to its original state. After speaking with tech support, there are more things to try and fix a connection issue than are present on their website. A more interview-type process for their web-based support would be helpful, or a list of items to try, even some of them may not solve your particular issue. Anyway, I was able to get the card to complete the setup at work using a wireless access point. While I was connected at work, the card uploaded 7 pictures, but there were 13 on the card. That's probably because we didn't leave it connected long enough. The iFi Manager, which is a web application, has a clean, simple interface. You have a choice of Home, your starting point, Upload History, Settings, and Account. The Home screen shows you these options along with thumbnails of the last 5 photos you uploaded. It also shows whether the photo contains geotag data. The upload history shows you a sample of the photos you've uploaded by date. The settings page lets you manage network profiles, the photo destinations, geotagging on or off, and upload notifications. The last option is for licenses, which, according to tech support, has no meaning for my card. This is a bit confusing when companies present options for things that have no meaning for the product you already registered in your account. Speaking of your account, this last major area lets you change your password, your name, no lawyer necessary, RSS feeds, device management, and delete your iFi account altogether. the geotagging ability is not done via GPS, but triangulation, similar to what the first-gen iPhone used to calculate your location. My experience with this so far has been perfect, but the only pictures I've uploaded were all taken at my house. When you click on the world symbol on your pictures in the iFi Manager, it shows you a map of the location using Google Maps. They also offer notifications via email, SMS, or Twitter. The result of all this work on this card was that I am returning the card to the company I bought it from on the internet. It just didn't work very well for me. That may not be your... But I decided to return the card because of the lack of connectivity sensitivity, and it just didn't work out well for me. Instead, for the same $104, actually less, I'm going to purchase and did a geotagging device, which I'll review soon, and also I'm going to use the Huda Geo software that was reviewed on Allison's wonderful podcast at an earlier date. Thank you, Allison. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Well, thanks for that review, Bruce. You know, Bruce and I discussed whether or not he should do that review because he was all excited before he got it, and then he told me he was going to do a review up front. But then when he realized that he was actually going to send it back, he thought maybe he shouldn't do the review. But we talked about it and we decided that it was important to not just do the happy reviews. Sometimes you need to learn about what to avoid. Thanks, Bruce. Great job. You can follow Bruce at twitter.com/noblesongster. Well, there's a lot of times you need to take a batch of photos and make a set of smaller versions of them. I know I've needed to do that to put them up on the web or to email to people who have lower broadband connections or no broadband at all. Since Apple's Mail started doing that automatically for me, I haven't needed it quite as much, but I do like to put up smaller images online. I also like to put a drop shadow on them for the web, and I know people like to put watermarks on their photos when they're really serious about their photography part. This week, I'm going to review two different shareware applications that both set about solving the same problem, batch converting a bunch of photos by rules you apply. And then at the end, I'll tell you which one I would buy. We're going to start with QuickScale from CodingMammoth.com. When they sent me the license for QuickScale, they included a copy of their excellent manual. They said it was a work in progress, but it sure gave me the relevant information in a short but efficient way. The manual explains that they support four different types of scaling. Never would have occurred to me to even ask for more than one way. So I was curious, so I actually read the manual. I know, don't tell Victor. QuickScale can scale your images using normal, stretch, crop, box, and actually a fifth one called mixed. The author walks through each of the options, explaining why you'd use each one, showing example photographs, and even walking through specific size examples, too. I won't walk through all the options in detail, but it's nice to know you've got those options. I was very intrigued by the naming options in QuickScale. The author explains that due to the technology of tokens from Apple, which I'd never heard of before, you can create your own complete custom name. You can put custom prefixes, suffixes, add dates into the names, and even add indexes. The interface to do this is really nice. It's sort of like tagging. You select the options you want, and you kind of drag them around in the order you want. It's very nice. QuickScale supports JPEG, PNG, GIF, and TIFF, and the author explains why you might choose one format over the other, which is kind of nice. Say, for example, if you need a transparent image for the web, you'd want a PNG or a GIF. QuickScale supports watermarking, but at first I was a little disappointed in the options, but bear with me through this entire explanation. You get to choose from 9 positions on the photograph, you know, from the top, center, bottom, center, left, center, right, center, and then the corners and dead center. And you can change the margin around which you put the watermark, and you can choose a background color to the watermark to make sure it stands out. I was really bummed at first because I couldn't figure out a way to change the fonts, though. It kept nagging at me, though, that the developer would do such a great job with everything else in the software and miss something as obvious as being able to change the font. I kept looking at that and I kept thinking, you know, he's got to have put that in there, or she, I'm not actually sure. Anyway, I finally went back a long time later, and I kept poking around, and then I realized that the font options were not where you created the watermark. They were up in the menu bar under Format. I even figured out that if you bring up the color wheel, you do have an option to change the opacity to make it nice and gray. That's perfect. I think a clear enhancement to this software would be to have the font button right where all the other text options are, because he's got all kinds of stuff. You've got, you know, left justified, right justified, center. You've got spacing. You can make bulleted lists and styles, all these things. It's even got a ruler, but you can't change the font there. So it was pretty annoying at first, but then when I realized you can do that, I calmed down quite a bit. Choosing photos to scale in quick scale could not have been easier. You just hit File, Import, and then you choose from Folders, iPhoto, or Aperture Libraries. Select the photos you want, and they come up in a grid on screen in quick scale. The display is very pleasing with a dark gray background and a nice slider for changing the size of the thumbnails. Down on the right side, you see five major things you can set about your scaled image. First up is the type of scaling, like we discussed before, and you can select your longest or shortest dimensions. Now, this is a really good way to define the photo size because, think about it, if you define just the longest side, then you can get portrait and landscape images that are all the same size. For example, if I set the longest side to 200 pixels, then the landscapes will be 200 wide, the portraits will be 200 tall. That's exactly what I want. I don't want the width always to be 200 or the height always to be 200. I want the longest dimension to be 200. Well, next up is the location for your scaled images. You have a choice of original location, existing, or new folder, and you can choose to remove the original if that's what you want. Naming is up next, where you can keep the original name or create these cool custom names that I described earlier, like adding the index and the date and all that sort of thing. Then you choose your file format, throw on the watermark, and you're ready to hit export. In the blink of an eye, you've got scaled images. I mean, really fast. I did 20 photos at mixed scaling with a watermark over to PNG, and it was under like 2 seconds. I mean, really, really impressive speed. QuickScale has a really cool feature. You can create a droplet. The idea is that you figure out a set of options you like a well-placed watermark, the size is just right, you know, just get it all just the way you're going to want to do it every time, and then you save that as a droplet. Then when you want a batch of photos resized the exact same way, you just drag them onto the droplet in your Finder. I tested this and it was amazing. I set up my options, selected File, Create QuickScale Droplet, and I saved it to my desktop. Then I grabbed a bunch of photos and dragged them onto the droplet. I had chosen the option to allow me to create a new folder for the scaled images. Sure enough, the droplet asked for the new folder name and location. I navigated to that folder, and there were my scaled images with the watermark all set. Beautiful feature. I really liked QuickScale. I found it easy to use, and it did a great job. QuickScale is 15 euros, so that makes it around $19 US today. But they also have an education license for only 10 euros, and they have a family pack option and a business pack. Check out QuickScale at codingmammoth.com. Next up, we're going to look at Resize Me from resize-me.com. This is going to be hard because, you know, I really liked QuickScale. What am I going to do if I like them both? How will we choose? Well, let's dig in and find out. You know what a big old manual reader I am. Well, okay, not normally, but I did like the one for QuickScale. So I decided to check out the help for Resize Me to get kind of a feel of the lay of the land for how the tool worked. But I got that sad little message we all hate to see. Help is not available for Resize Me. Bummer. Well, it turns out it's not that complicated, and I was able to pretty much figure things out. Not completely, though. Well, let's just poke around and figure it out. Resize Me starts with a blank screen on the left and just a few things on the right. Under the blank area is a plus and minus sign, so I guess that I should hit the plus button. That allowed me to navigate again into Folders, iPhoto, or Aperture Libraries. I selected the same 20 photos, and they all came in a list, not as thumbnails. First, I didn't like that, but you'll see why that comes in okay. Instead, selecting a photo from the list gives you a view of what your exported, scaled photo will look like when it's done. That was probably more useful than the pretty grid in QuickScale, but I did like the way the pretty grid looked, but this really does give you more information. Under the example photo, you get to see a set of controls which at first seemed really limited until you realize there's a plugin to go through each of the options you'll be able to change. So instead of showing all the options at once, they just show you the options for the one you've selected. Scale, the choices you get to go through in that pull-down are scale and resize, rotate, crop, drop shadow, reflection, output format, flip, and watermark. Let's take a quick glance at each one of these. In scale and resize, you have four choices: width, height, width and height, or don't scale. First, I thought the last one was an odd option, but I can picture a scenario where I might want to add a watermark and a drop shadow, but have it on the original size. Makes perfect sense. One thing I was disappointed in, that you couldn't just say max dimension to a value so it would make both portrait and landscape images the same size. This is where I said maybe there is a way to do it, but since I didn't have a manual and I couldn't figure it out on my own, I'm going to say you can't do it. If I could have defined the width or height, I would be able to have... If I could have defined the maximum dimension, I could have had the images all come out the same size. But by defining the width or height, you will get different sizes to your images. The only way around this is to do all the portrait ones first, then the landscape ones in a second pass, which is not ideal. Rotate has pretty obvious options, except that they let you choose to make all images landscape or portrait. I thought that was kind of strange, but then maybe that's what you're supposed to do, and then you say, okay, make them all this width, and then you flip them back in another step? I don't know. Resize Me has a crop option, but I can't figure out how to use this any more than I actually understood Quick Scale's crop option. I mean, how could an automatic crop do any justice to a whole set of photos? I don't get it. Maybe someone can explain it to me? But this was an option in both applications. That's okay. I mean, maybe there's a way you would need it. Well, my favorite option in Resize Me is Drop Shadow. I am such a sucker for a drop shadow. Have you ever noticed that every image on my blog has one? The way I create that is I take screen snapshots with Sketch, and then I put a drop shadow on with that. If I have to use another tool to get the shot, like, say, trying to capture a pull-down menu that Sketch isn't very good at, I can still paste them into Sketch and add my drop shadow. Resize Me lets you choose the color of the shadow, angle, offset, blur, and opacity. It's a drop shadow addict's dream. That's something that Quick Scale does not have. If you're not up for a drop shadow, how about a swanky apple-like reflection? You can adjust the opacity and how much of a reflection you can see, and this is when I first realized how important that single image view is. I can move the sliders and adjust until it's just right because I can see the effect of the changes before I do an export. Next up you'll see is the output format. They have a ton of output formats, way more than Quick Scale. It lets you do JPEG, GIF, PNG, and TIFF just to get you started, throw in TGA, EXR, and SGI, whatever the heck those are, then Photoshop's PSD format and PDF, and finally, JPEG 2000 and BMP for the close. If you can't find a format you like in there, you're trying too hard. You can also set the quality of the output as well. The next option is just silly. You can flip the images horizontally or vertically. Now, why would I want to do that? To a whole slew of photos. Would it be for when I got home and realized that I accidentally took all of my pictures in a mirror? Doesn't hurt anything, but I thought it was kind of goofy. Well, finally, we get to play with a watermark, and this is where Resize Me did a good job. You get the same 9 region choices of where to put it, but you can also choose the opacity and mess with the fonts. It was easier to find than on Quick Scale, that's for sure. They added another option. You can change the angle of the text. But I guess it might be fun to sometimes maybe put a diagonal watermark across the image. I think they did a little math error on how this works, though. They don't rotate it about the center of the text. It rotates about the end. So if you try to center the text that's diagonally rotated, it actually drops to the bottom instead. I did just a little work here on how that actually works is, I think, in order. Unfortunately, there's a little bit more wrong here in the watermarks. The size of the watermark in the preview does not match the output file. It's much bigger, so that kind of takes away from some of the advantage of having that little preview. You know what, though? Overall, I really liked Resize Me. It did a great job, and it was really, really fast, just like Quick Scale. Resize Me is available from resize-me.com, like I said, and this is $30. Okay, I guess it's time to bottom line it. I've got to call a winner. They're both wicked fast, and they're both pretty inexpensive, but Quick Scale does win the price war at $19 US versus $30. Resize Me wins, though, with that drop shadow. Did I tell you I'm a sucker for drop shadows? And the reflections. But then Quick Scale, on the other hand, wins for having that droplet feature so you can make lots of these images, you know, these scaled images. Resize Me supports more output formats, but to tell you the truth, Quick Scale does do all the formats I'd actually want. Quick Scale has better options for renaming files with the use of the Apple tokens. But ResizeMe does a better job of doing the previews to show you what your scaled images will look like when they're done. QuickScale had the important feature of being able to make all of the scaled images the same size regardless of whether the images were landscape or portrait. Okay, I hate to pick one because they're great programs, but I'm going to give the win to QuickScale for me because price, sizing of portrait landscape images the same, and having that droplet feature combined would be what would really drive me. If they added a drop shadow, though, I'd be in heaven. Okay, so this is why you should come to the live show. I just finished recording all of that, and I looked down to the chat room, and Maurice is in there saying, but Allison, ResizeMe can make the portrait and landscape pictures the same size. Again, here's where I would have suggested that perhaps a little manual would have helped. It turns out if you tell it to make the width and height the same number, then it'll make the tall ones that number and the wide ones that number, which is so unintuitive. But he's right. If you put, so I went through and I actually did it live here in the chat room in the live show. I set the width to 300 and the height to 300, and it made all my little thumbnails exactly the same size. The portrait ones were 300 tall and the landscape ones were 300 wide. Exactly what I was looking for. So I don't know. Go make your own decision. I can't tell you which one you should buy now. Well, one of the things I love about Honda Bob is what a geek he is. He stopped by to visit yesterday, and he showed us a really fun little gadget. It's a pen that's actually a video camera. Yes, the latest version of the original spy camera pen. Bob showed us how it works. First of all, it's oddly a really nice pen. I mean, it's really nice to write with. I thought that was kind of an interesting side feature. Anyway, the top of the pen is silver with a very small silver button that turns on the camera. You have to hold it down for a couple of seconds so you don't accidentally hit it. And when the camera is active, a tiny little blue light on hopefully your side of the camera comes on. You have to pay attention to that if you're going to spy on someone and make sure it's rotated so the blue light is towards you, right? Well, then you swing it around and take video with it. Once we've taken some video, and I do have to admit that we were flailing the pen around quite a bit, Bob unscrewed the end of the pen and revealed that it was actually a USB drive. He plugged that into his Windows laptop, and it came up just like a thumb drive, and he was able to open the movies in Windows Media Player. Now, keep in mind, this is a pen, right? The camera is less than like, I mean, the whole pen is less than like a half an inch across, like 3/8 of an inch across, and it costs only about $30, $40. The video would have been acceptable if you didn't fling it around like we did, because it's really easy to move a pen that much, right? You're going to have trouble holding that steady. It's only VGA quality video, but it looked okay in broad daylight. Not that good indoors. The pen drive is 4 gigabytes, so with only VGA quality, you can put a lot on that. I think Bob said he could put 2 hours worth. The audio is nothing to write home about. It was pretty clipped, but again, think about the device you're working with. We tried it on the Mac, and it turns out the drive is not formatted so the Mac can see it. Bob gave me carte blanche to reformat it so I could read it and write to it, but then I realized the camera software is probably on the pen drive and that would be destroyed if I did that, so I didn't go for it. Anyway, if you're looking for a really nice pen that happens to have a spy cam in it, check out the link in the show notes to DealExtreme.com. They have it for $37, but I hunted around a couple other places and found it for a bit cheaper, but this is where Bob bought it. Well, remember when I was asking people to claim continents? Way, way, way back, Paul started writing to me from Peru, so he was officially awarded custody of all of South America. He and I have chatted in emails for years, not always about tech stuff. It's been fun to learn about the life of a student in Peru. Well, he sent in a little audio clip for us. It was very cool for me personally to get to hear his voice after all these years of simply reading his words.
Hello, Alison. This is Paul from South America here. I was listening that you felt your reading of an ad for Honda Bob sounded a little boring. So maybe a mix with a little South American Spanish will do it good. Well, for the listeners who don't already know who Honda Bob is, él es un excelente mecánico that drives a tu casa y arregla tu auto while you descansas sentado en un cómodo sofá. Honda Bob solo arregla Hondas o Acuras, and just in el área de Los Ángeles o Orange County. If you want to know more about Honda Bob, lo puedes llamar por teléfono al 562-531-2321, that's 562-531-2321, o escribirle un correo electrónico a hdabob@aol.com. También puedes visitar su página web at hdabob.com. HDA Bob's mobile service no está afiliado a Honda, Acura o Honda Worldwide.
Well, I know I've said it before, but this is a very special chit-chat across the pond because this week we not only have Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie, we also have Robert Lachman from the PhotographyOfTheMac.com podcast, or website, I guess it is. How are you doing today, guys?
Which one first?
Bart, how are you today?
I'm grand. I just got back from spending most of the week away at a conference, which I hate doing because I can't sleep well in a bed that isn't mine.
But you had better broadband, you said.
Yeah, there was something wrong when your hotel has better broadband than you do. But maybe it was because it was a techie conference, so maybe they did something special for us. I don't know.
I wonder. So Robert's joining us because we're going to have a little redux on the RAW versus JPEG discussion. Robert's a staff photographer for the Los Angeles Times. So in theory, he knows what he's talking about, too. First, we're going to start out with Security Light because a couple of things came up. Why don't you start us off there, Bart?
Yeah, I suppose the first thing we should do is a little follow-up on one of the three things we talked about last week, which was the Acrobat and Adobe Reader flaw, which there's no patch to. And we said it only affected the Adobe products, and you just turn off JavaScript within those products, and you'd be fine. And unfortunately, it sort of happens quite a bit, actually. Whenever someone finds a flaw, all the researchers hammer at it, and what looks like a tiny little flaw at first suddenly becomes a giant big flaw. And now they've found a way to exploit it without the need for JavaScript within your PDFs, which means that the fix, in inverted commas, of turning off JavaScript ceases to have any effect. And it also means that Preview's lack of support for JavaScript ceases to have any form of protection to it. So according to a couple of Mac-based AV firms, it does now affect OS X. Preview is vulnerable, and what's worse is that all OS X system-based PDF viewing is vulnerable, so that includes Quick Look and so forth. So it looks like we're not safe, and of course there is no patch, so I guess it's just be careful time, which is rather annoying.
So technically that doesn't fit Security Light, does it?
it doesn't technically, but at the same time we're sort of following up from last week, and we also had a very nice email from a listener, George, who's not the other listener George.
Yeah, this time it was George Smith, not George from Tulsa.
All these listener Georges, it's confusing. But new listener George, so thanks very much for the
email.
Giving
them numbers.
Oh, no,
George
first
one,
come,
George
first served.
Well, yeah, George from Tulsa would be George 1. George Smith could be George 2. Well, anyway.
So we need to keep a register. Okay. Second up, we have Security Light.
So back up just a little bit. I cut you off when you were going to actually add content here, and I was babbling. But George Smith was the one who actually asked the question, what about Apple's Preview? He sent that in and emailed us.
Yeah, but he also had the answer in his email, which was a quote from Intigo's website, where they have a blog post explaining exactly why Preview actually is vulnerable. So,
Okay. And I put that link in the show notes, too.
Ah, excellent.
So next.
Next up we have a real one, as in proper Security Light by the book. Firefox has released an update to 3.0.7. Fixes some fairly hefty flaws, including the usual stuff, you know, remote code execution, blah, 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 all that kind of carry on. But also one that's a little more nasty. It was a flaw which allowed the content of the address bar to be faked, which actually has a very serious impact. Because we always tell people that if you go to a website, you know, it's called, you know, www.mybank.whatever, and if it has the little padlock, then it couldn't be anyone else. Because,
right,
you know, the name of the server has to match the name on the SSL cert, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's protection. But if what is actually written in the address bar isn't the real server you're at, then the server that Firefox is checking the SSL cert with could be hacker.com. So the SSL cert will validate. But when you look at the menu bar, it will say www.mybank.com and have the padlock.
Now, how would you end up there in the first place, though? Would you have clicked a link in an email?
Possibly, yeah.
So if you hovered over the link, and it would show you the real URL underneath, right?
Should do, but, you know, a little bit of redirecting and stuff. Yeah, you'd have to trick people into clicking on a link to get them there in the first place. So there would still be a little bit of work to be done by the attacker. But it's a pretty powerful weapon to be able to circumvent the old padlock. It's not something you want. But being proper security light, you know, the update is out there, so Firefox will ask you to let it update itself and just say yes.
Well, since Firefox asked me that 3 times a week, I'm pretty good at it by now. I do procrastinate sometimes. It's like, could I just work for a whole day without an update? That'd be nice.
Okay, well, there are updates to plugins usually, because Firefox itself isn't updated that often. This is only the 7th update since Firefox 3 came out.
Okay. Yeah, really? It seems like it's a lot more often than I suppose. Well, they numbered it 3.0.7. I don't know.
it's pretty clear. But no, the plugins, I mean, if you have a big selection of plugins, particularly NoScript, which is updated exceptionally often, you're going to have a lot of updates. But that's not Firefox. That's the various plugins and bits and pieces.
Okay, what I'm reacting to is how often I get an update that when I execute it, the next time I open Firefox, my browser takes me automatically to the Firefox homepage and says, thank you for updating, which is not what I want. I want to be taken to my homepage, not to their homepage. So I see
that
really often. Yeah, but it's the first tab. I have to close it to get to my homepage. So that's got to be more than 7 times. I'm going to research that while you go on to the next one.
I'm pretty sure it is just those 7 times since Firefox 3. So update, and then there's a bit of bad news then, which is technically not Security Light anymore, is that the same flaws apparently also affect Mozilla Thunderbird, but they haven't released an update because, of course, as I've mentioned before, the Mozilla Foundation have basically wiped their hands of Thunderbird, which is exceptionally annoying.
Oh, well, that's a good reason to go with, what was that other, something box?
Well, Postbox. Yeah, we don't know that Postbox isn't vulnerable. Huh. We don't know one way or the other with Postbox. It's based off the same code base. So the chances are it would be too.
I see.
The other one that may be or may not be is Camino, which I don't know the answer to either.
Oh, yeah.
But at least the Camino folks, that browser is under active development. So the chances are Camino will try to update itself within the next couple of days as well. And again, just say yes.
It's sort of like just say no. In this case, it's just say yes.
Yeah, it's the opposite. So that's it really for Security Light.
Now, Robert, are you good? Do you update your browsers constantly every minute they ask for it?
As soon as Bart tells me to.
There you go. Perfect, perfect.
I need him to drop by my house, though, I think, because it's pretty close. Probably right on his way home, right?
Yeah, just down the road. Yeah, just a couple of 1,000 miles to the left.
Definitely. All right. Well, we wanted to open up the discussion again. Last week, I asked Bart to explain to me RAW versus JPEG and why I would want to use RAW. And Robert, being a photography kind of guy, wanted to join in the discussion. And now, hopefully, you're going to tell us how Bart's wrong and I don't really need it. Right, Robert?
Bart's wrong and you don't really need it.
That's not what you're saying.
Oh, I'm just trying to be good here. Actually, I think you're both right. You know, this is one of those questions of what you're trying to do, what you're comfortable doing, how much you want to tweak your stuff, and how much hard drive space you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I did actually buy an extra hard drive before I started shooting RAW. It's something we talked about earlier in the year when Allison kindly bought me Aperture. Then I went, yeah, but I can't use it till I buy a new hard drive.
Now, actually, I said that RAW is an artifact by the hard drive manufacturers, that they're just trying to get us to buy more hard drives, right?
Yeah, I think that's a little conspiracy theory-esque. I don't think we actually have a link there, but I doubt they object to the concept.
Really? So go on, Robert. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think now, for example, if you're going out to shoot a track meet and you're going to shoot 100 pictures, 1,000 pictures, do you really need to shoot RAW? I mean, the cameras today are so good that I think JPEGs are just fine. I probably would recommend that for most people. It's just a question of how much speed do you really... I mean, RAW is really for the person that wants to go out. You know, you're shooting pictures of that mountain scene. You're shooting all those scenics. And you're really composing that picture and you're really looking to get that perfect color, that perfect exposure. You may want to tweak it a little, but probably most of those people are shooting HDR and doing 3 and 4 images now. So it's a great concept, but I think for the average person, it might be just a little too much. I mean, the cameras are so good today. Don't your pictures look great when you shoot them?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't really find myself in a lot of situations where I'm thinking that I really wish I could tweak this beyond what I already can.
This may be a place where you live comes into it, because I don't know. No, honestly, you know, in Ireland, we actually have a lot of very challenging lighting. What probably people don't realize is quite how far north Ireland is. So in the winter, the sun doesn't actually come more than 30 degrees above the horizon, which is really very little. So the entire day, even at midday, we have long, deep shadows. So as soon as you go out any time in the winter and take pictures, all your shadows are just gone, black. So you want to bring a bit of detail back into those. Then the summer comes along and you think, oh, great, the shadows are gone. And then we have these white cotton wool clouds that are always there pretty much. And they're very detailed. So as soon as you blow a part of them out, they begin to look really poor because it's detail, 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 and then a big white blob in the middle. And it looks terrible. So then I'm blowing out highlights every second minute. So I'm either have shadows I'm losing everything in, or I'm blowing stuff out every minute. And I mean, I went to road because I got so frustrated by these conditions. But I'm not sure you run into that at your track meets.
Yeah, but I thought that bright sunlight is not the best way to take photographs anyway, that you really would like it overcast. I would think that it would be easier to photograph in overcast conditions.
Yeah, but yeah. The nice thing about Irish landscapes is the blue and green. So you have beautiful green and beautiful blue. And if you go on an overcast day, the Irish landscape looks ick.
Actually, I would agree with Allison here. See, I'm going to agree with Allison because when you go out to shoot that track meet, you have to shoot when it's happening. You don't get to decide which direction those people run. It might be backlit. It might be late in the day. So really, you don't get to choose and sit there and wait for the sun to be just right and things like that. So in reality, you might even need that raw better, but are you really going to go back and tweak each one of those photos?
Yeah. Yeah. My PR, I think, was 450 pictures at one track meet, so probably not so much. I'm lucky if I barred them down to maybe 200, you know.
Well, you got to edit a little. That's a good thing to do. That's probably when people ask me, how do they... You know, what are the most important things to being a better photographer? And I don't care if you're shooting at a party or anything like this. I usually tell them the most important things is to shoot like at least three pictures of that same group. And then when you get back, edit and throw away the bad ones. And all of a sudden, you become a great photographer.
That and cropping. I find cropping to make a lot of people think I'm this amazing photographer, but I'll just crop out all the crap and then make the center of the photo the way it should have been taken.
I'll give you my two other ones that will really make you the expert. One is you have to learn to remove red eye. It's really not that hard. There's about three different ways. That's the most important. And then the second, if you can make people look a little younger by maybe softening up a few of those wrinkles, you'll be the favorite photographer ever.
I actually have a little tutorial on my website that talks about how to do it in Photoshop Elements, and I've done this for a couple of older friends of mine, where you take the photograph and you make a layer, and the second layer you fuzz it all out, you make it real blurry, and then you change the opacity of it, and then you go in and erase it around the eyes and the teeth. And so what you get is these bright, sparkly eyes and bright, sparkly teeth, but the wrinkles are virtually gone. And you slide that slider until it looks, you know, believable. And people love my pictures.
Just another thing just occurs to me. Maybe it also matters just how important it is that you actually get the shot. If you're going to an important event, say some sort of final or something, and you absolutely don't want to miss the shot, and there's a chance that you know, like Robert said, you don't control the lighting. They could be running into the sun, they could be running away from the sun, who only knows? So maybe in those kind of situations where you really need to be sure you get the shot, maybe then you might consider switching to RAW for that event.
Because if they were backlit, you could do more to fix it if it was in RAW?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. You know, Robert, I told Bart, I went out and I took about 20 photos. I went down to the beach and, I mostly did that to piss him off. I said, yeah, you know, it was 5 o'clock at night. I was down there in shorts and a t-shirt walking in the ocean, which was very cold, by the way, but it wasn't outside of that. And I took 20 photos that are just completely varied. You know, I took pictures of the sand, pictures of seashells, pictures of the ocean, you know, looking down into the water, out towards the mountains of the houses along the way. And I took each one twice. I took it in RAW and JPEG, and then I sat down with him and I messed around with him, and I couldn't tell the difference. I couldn't tell what I should be doing. And he said, maybe I didn't take any bad photographs was the problem.
Well, if you didn't take anything that actually required the extra adjustment, then it doesn't make any difference that the adjustment's available, because it's purely theoretical.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm trying to figure out how do I have to go take a bad picture, like set the aperture wrong or the shutter speed wrong or something, take it off program mode and make it fail.
Set the white balance wrong on purpose. And I think the power would become quite clear quite quickly. Or underexpose them all by a stop.
See, I don't even know how to do that because I don't go off that little P button all that often. Maybe this gets down to what Robert's saying is it has to do with what you're trying to do. I mean, when you're taking a picture of one of those little tiny white flowers and it's against that dark background, and that gets pretty challenging.
Actually, one way to probably know maybe if you need it or not is, I don't know, Robert, you shoot Canon, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
So I know on the Nikons, there's a setting which is thankfully on by default, that whenever you blow out the highlights, when you're previewing them on the camera, the blown highlights flash. They blink at you to show you where you've blown them out. Is there an equivalent in Canon?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I haven't used the newest cameras, and I'd assume they are. I'm using the Mark IIs, which is about technology from 2005. So
it's only three years.
Yeah, it's actually before that. That's when I got them. But so it's probably technology before that. But I think on the newest stuff they do. But I can't really answer that question because I don't have the new cameras.
Now, where's this flash, Bart? What are you talking about?
Okay, so you take your picture and you look down at the screen and it shows you the picture you've just taken.
Right.
If you have blown highlights, they will be blinking.
That's
from black to white to black to white to black to white if you have a blown highlight somewhere.
And if you set it to do that, because the normal display doesn't do that. You have to flip through the displays, like you have to flip past the one that shows the histogram and go to the one that shows the flashing.
Okay, my D40 did that by itself.
Okay, you must have just had it on that setting. You have to, I forget which button you push. It must be the little toggle
down.
On the round thing. Yeah, the up and down toggle. That flips through the different options. So you have it set to the one that flashes, but it's just not automatically there.
I'm pretty sure my camera came with it there and that I accidentally turned it off at one stage, and then it took me a while to figure out how to turn it back on, but I'm pretty sure that's what it did before I messed with it.
Okay.
But anyway, what I noticed is that I was getting loads of that blinking, and then I started thinking, well, maybe I need to go shoot RAW because I'm losing all of these bleeding highlights all the time. But if you have that setting on and you never get that blinking, well then, you know, you're probably in much less need of it.
Yeah, maybe I don't think I've deleted those pictures off the camera yet. I'll have to go check. I'll go see if any of them have those blown highlights. That would be interesting. I have definitely seen that. I think I went out one day and just practiced taking pictures of the sky and changing aperture settings and stuff, and I paid a lot of attention to that as I kept changing the aperture until I wouldn't get those blinking
things. Yeah, because clouds look terrible when you clip half of them out.
So if you take the picture and it's blinking, but you took it in RAW, you can get those highlights back?
To an extent, obviously not infinitely far, but you can get them back to between 1 and 1.5 stops, which is, you know, equivalent to an exposure compensation of 3 to 4 clicks on the Nikons, which is a fair bit.
Hmm. Okay. Well, anything else on that, Robert, that you wanted to add in?
Well, I think one of the things to try to think about, it does give you more latitude, and so that if you're in a situation where you're worried about the color balance, you know, you're under fluorescent light, you're shooting indoors, you know, with just regular lights from lamps and things like that, and you're a little worried about, you know, you just don't want it to look that way. You want a little more control of the actual color balance. You know, RAW really is the way to go. It does give you a chance to fix that when you get back. But like I say, if you change all those settings, you know, you change the setting for your color balance in your camera, and then you go outside and you forget and you shoot outside with a change, now you got real problems. So, you know, it's one of those things where auto is usually best for me. Tell the truth, I'm a professional, but 99% of the time I shoot on auto because half the time I'll forget to set it back and I'll forget to change it, and then I got real problems. So, you know, that's kind of one of the funny things that it depends how good you are at doing things. Sometimes auto really is the best way to go.
I've actually forced myself to do a checklist. When I pick up the camera for the first time in a day, I will turn it on. I will set it to F8. I will set it to auto white balance. I will set it to to 200 ISO. And then I'll go out and shoot. And if I don't do that, I will have forgotten some setting from the last time. Oh, and I also set the exposure compensation back to 0. Because the chances are I changed those last time for some reason. I may have been out shooting a sunset or something. And then I go out and I completely forget about it. And then I come back home and the pictures are all terrible. So I've actually forced myself. First time I pick up the camera, check those things.
But didn't you shoot in RAW? So it should be no trouble fixing any of that stuff, right?
Well, no, because RAW can help you. If you've been shooting at 1600 ISO on a D40, you are going to have grain everywhere. And, you know, you can't fix that by having shot raw. That's just gone.
I thought it was good for everything.
Oh, if only, if only.
You know, I don't feel like such a moron now. I thought something was wrong with my camera because every time I tried to shoot it on aperture priority, I was getting these flaming blue photographs. I mean, just like I took them underwater, they were so blue. And I thought something was wrong with the camera. And I just every once in a while, I'd try using it. Oh, it's still broken. And I kept forgetting about it. And then one day I was in it and I went, wait a minute. They said something about a white balance button I could have pushed. And I looked at it on fluorescent lighting or something like that. And I'm taking pictures
outside. Yeah, fluorescent turns the world blue.
Yeah, yeah. So that would have saved me in RAW, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, luckily I just screamed and went back to the program mode.
The one thing I wanted to mention was you talked about elements before. Elements does do conversion. It has its own converter in it, which is really nice. So if you do want to buy that as your one-stop shop as you move up, you can convert RAW with it, and you had asked about that.
You mean convert it from RAW to JPEG?
It has a converter, so it opens the RAW files up. You work on them, and then you save them out as JPEGs.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, you know, I found I haven't been using Photoshop Elements as much since I got Aperture because it's got so many cool little controls. But it is twice as much.
Yeah, it really depends on what you do. And then you don't have things like you being able to use layers and just a little more control. It really works more into my workflow to go straight into something like Photoshop or Photoshop Elements. I'm kind of old school, so, you know, I'm a little older than you guys, so.
Yeah, you probably read paper newspapers and books in paper and that sort of thing.
Occasionally, yes, that is true. I'll admit it. Although I did handle a Kindle for the first time.
Oh,
that
really?
Was kind of fun. Yeah.
The old one?
It's the new Kindle, yeah. It was pretty neat. It's so thin, it's amazing.
I'm starting to want it, but I'm trying to figure out if I want it the same way I wanted Robo, but I don't need it. Because I haven't bought a book. I bought two books probably in the last 2 years, and it's not that I don't read. I am never without a book, but I've got a friend at the gym who has fantastic taste in books, and just every month or couple of weeks, she'll walk in and go, here, read this, and it'll always be this fantastic book. So I have no justification. I'll have to have her hand me a book and then turn around and buy it on Kindle.
Yeah. I think the price point's a little high for that thing right now. I mean, it's just basically a book reader and a computer with a very slow browser. Yeah. And for that $350 price point, I'm waiting until the price comes down and you can slide in that DVD and watch a movie.
On a grayscale screen?
Oh, I got to be color too. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah, the reason it's so neat for reading books is because it's e-ink, so it's actually not a screen. But that's exactly the reason why you don't want to slide your DVD in the side.
Yeah, doesn't it feel like something that ought to be maybe $150, not $350?
That's the way I look at it, because you're talking about spending, it's $359, but it doesn't stop there. You have to then, buy books or subscriptions to newspapers or blogs and things like that. So you're, it's fairly expensive, and then you got to add to it as you want to get stuff for it.
Yeah,
it should probably come like our mobile phones do. You get a contract with Amazon, and then you basically get the book reader for free.
That's the way you think it would be.
But I guess since you don't have a subscription fee or anything with Amazon, you get to. I kind of like the pay-as-you-go model a little bit better. I don't like this. I'm forced into paying a monthly fee thing. That kind of. I'm kind of tired of all the things I pay that are monthly fees. All of a sudden, you look at your checkbook, you got no money left.
I think you're right on that one. And the books are priced appropriately. I think are they like $9 or $10?
Yeah. But how much is a book that they've paid to have to print?
Not much more.
So if they don't have to pay to print it or deliver it or have a truck take it anywhere or staff people in a store to sell it to you, why does it cost so much? I would think the e-books ought to be half the price.
Oh, yeah, it's not like Audible. They don't have to hire anybody to read it, do they? I forgot.
Yeah, there's no cost, really, to them of the digital delivery of that.
Yeah,
that's huge profits.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm not sure it is, Allison. I'm pretty sure that the actual printing and stuff isn't all that expensive in the grand scheme of things, and most of the price of your book isn't the paper and the ink and the running it around the country. It's paying for the rights to publish it.
Oh,
Money is going to...
To who?
To the publishing companies. The publishing companies, not the authors, the publishing companies.
Well, I understand that, but you don't think that the price of printing books and shipping them across the country and across the world is a huge expense? I think it's enormous.
I'm going to agree with Allison on this one, because I'm in the publishing business, and delivery is pretty darn expensive.
I just heard Leo Laporte talking about, I forget which newspaper it was, but they did the math on what it costs to deliver, to create the newsprint, print it, the cost of the ink, the cost of the paper, and the cost of the delivery. And the math he did said they could send a Kindle to every single subscriber and they would save money. If they sent them a Kindle over something like over 2 years, it would cost less than sending them the newspaper.
Easily.
So,
when you think, okay, but are books quite the same? I mean, newspapers are printed every single day, whereas books is somewhat different. I mean, you print the book once and you ship it once.
No, you got to ship a lot of them, and you got to ship them a lot of places, and you have to ship them and ship them again and ship them again. You don't just ship once. Yeah. I mean, each book only gets shipped once, but each newspaper only gets shipped once too.
Yeah, but the percentage out of each individual newspaper is going to be quite small. The problem is that with a newspaper subscription over 2 years, that's 600-700 times it has to be printed and shipped.
Plus, they're cheaper too. The paper's only 50 cents or 75 or dollar.
Yeah, but then again, that's why all the newspaper companies are losing money right and left because of that closing down. So,
well, that's more because of the advertising. The actual, I think, the part of the delivery on the newspapers is the smallest part. You know, it's the advertising is really where you're having a hard time.
Right, right. Well, and that's what really funds it. It's not the 50 cents for the paper, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Craigslist is to blame.
Well, yeah, right, right. That's what they say. Have you ever sat back and thought about the fact that, you know, this has to do with TV advertising. I was thinking about it the other day, and I was saying, well, you know, you really got to watch those ads. You know, I mean, it's bad that we skip those ads. You know, I know we all do it, but, you know, they've got to make their money somehow. And then I realized, wait a minute, I'm paying $100 a month to watch TV. Why do I have to watch ads? I used to not pay $100 a month and I had to watch ads. Now I have to watch ads that are longer and pay them $100 a month. How did they trick us into that?
You've hit a lovely pet peeve of mine. So, you know the way in the UK they have the BBC, which is basically paid for by taxpayers through something called a license fee. So every household pays, I think it's about €200 a year for a licensing fee, which goes to the BBC, and they use that money to make all the programs. So you get high-quality television with no advertisement whatsoever, which is good. In Ireland, we sort of half follow that model. We have a licensing fee, and it was increased to the same level as the BBC's because our RTE is our one. They went, oh, well, the BBC get all this money and we don't. So we now give them exactly as much as they pay in the UK. But they advertise at us as well.
Nice compromise.
Yeah, so we pay as much, and yet we still get advertised at. And they just buy in American programs.
No,
they don't make quality TV.
I thought you don't have a TV.
I don't, but I still have to pay the licensing fee
because
I have a device. Yeah. If you possess a device capable of receiving broadcasts, then you have to have a TV license.
So what device is that?
And a computer account, because RTE broadcast over Real Player.
Oh, jeez.
So if you have a computer and the internet, you have to pay a TV license.
And it's Real Player, so all of this we're not insulting enough, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it annoys me no end. Anyway, sorry.
I'm not quite sure how I got us there from RAW versus JPEG, but that was just a little side rant I was going with.
Well, wasn't it the original when they first were making cable TV or even, remember, I go far enough back to when you actually used those rabbit ears and there was free TV, and the big push of, you know, cable or subscription TV was it was going to be no commercials. That was why you were paying for it.
How did they trick us?
They really tricked us, or people just are willing. You know, they seem to be conditioned, I guess, or something, and don't really, you know, I don't get it.
You know, we talk about that with the phones, too. You know, the telephones used to pay some exorbitant fee to AT&T, and it cost a fortune to make a long-distance phone call. Well, now I have free long-distance, but guess what? I'm paying $70 a month per person for cell phones. You know? Yeah, I've got free long distance for $210 a month.
They got you.
You know, and I used to pay $50-$60 a month for my landline. Now, of course, I still pay for my landline.
On top of your $200 a month.
Right. And I only pay for three of us, and not all four of us. So I don't understand. They tricked me on that one, too. Hey, before I forget, I looked up how many versions of Firefox there have been. Since I started with the Firefox 3.0 beta, so I'm going to count every version. It's 16.
And how many of those were beta releases?
It was Firefox 3.0, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, beta 4, beta 5, RC1, RC2, RC3. Then there was 3.0, so you definitely got to count 3.0, so you don't get to count 7, right? So it's 3.0, 3.01, 02, 03, 04. I'm going to skip over two they list here, 05, 06, and 07. So at the very least, you got to go with 8.
Well, no, because I installed 0 and updated once to 1. Twice to 2, 3 times to 3, etc. So I've updated 7 times.
Oh, so you didn't run Firefox 3.0 beta? I don't believe
that.
I
never run beta. No, I never run beta browsers. Browser is, there are two things, you know, the browser is just so important to my daily life, I cannot tolerate having a buggy browser. I need a stable production browser.
So you're not running Safari 4?
I'm actually tempted to, for the sole reason that I never actually use Safari. So as long as I have Firefox 3, I don't mind running beta of Safari because I don't use Safari as a browser. So I'm actually tempted in work to give it a go. And I might even run the beta of Camino 2 as well because I know I'll have Firefox 3.
Okay, so you never ever run a beta browser except when you do? Is that what you just told us?
Okay, actually, no, I need to rephrase. I never run a beta version of Firefox because I rely on it so heavily.
Ah, okay, so it's not because it's a browser, it's because it's Firefox.
See, I rely on the plugins very heavily. And I need a working browser at all times, and I need plugins, so that gives me an option of one.
All right, well, I just had to call you on that. But I believe I have run all 16 versions, because I believe in beta at all times. In fact, I'm kind of disappointed when they go full release. That's just not any fun.
So, it's all boring, yeah. Reliable.
What's up with that? Well, I think Google actually ruined that for us when they started coming out with everything was in beta, and you began to believe that beta meant stable.
Yeah, they really have perverted the whole concept of what these, you know, alpha, beta, like, release candidate. You know, Google have perverted all that, and now beta means, oh, it's new and shiny.
Exactly. If it's a full release, what fun is that? So you know how much I depend on Screen Steps. I've been running the beta for like the last month, and I have to update it every 15 days or so. They have it expire, so you get make sure you keep testing the latest one, and it works great.
So how many times have you updated that?
Oh, constantly. But it doesn't come up with a Firefox homepage when I do it.
Well, I should hope not.
Where do you go on the beta front, Robert?
I'm probably in the middle. I'll try anything, though. You know, it's I just enjoy trying the new stuff. It's kind of fun. That's all.
Definitely. All right. Well, I really appreciate coming on, Robert. This is interesting. I don't think anybody's ever said we're both right. That kind of takes the fun out of arguing.
Yeah, like I said to you before, it is a little more fun when you are arguing. It's just I can't explain it. But you told me that most of the people agree with me. So
yeah, everybody loves it.
You don't agree.
Yeah, everybody likes it when we bicker.
Okay, well then for next week, it's your job to find reasons why you hate cha-ching.
Ah, okay. So I'm going to have to load that up. That's a finance application?
Yeah, it's not free though. But you can load the demo, I guess.
Oh, okay. I don't believe in following my finances. I just don't like looking at it. It's too sad.
Is that better than...
I agree, until the recession kicked in, and now I have to.
Is that better than Quicken?
It depends on your definition of better. It's better for me because I don't actually understand finances, and I never managed to get one of these fancy apps to do anything.
Okay. Yeah, I find Quicken's even a little too much for me.
I could never... applications like Quicken, the best benefit of them is they say, yes, we can get your financial data from your financial institution. Well, I belong to a credit union, and they can never pull my information. I was doing my taxes, and we have some investments with Schwab, and it couldn't pull our Schwab data. It was just like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I have to type everything in by hand anyway. I actually stopped looking at my checking account, and I just trust the bank or the credit union, because I realized I've been balancing my checkbook every week or so for 28 years by the time I quit, and all I ever did was when I found a mistake, check it, and they were right and I was wrong, and I would change my checkbook. And I, you know, once I did have an incident where they said that I pulled $100 out of one ATM and I walked the one right next to it and took out another $100. So I walked into the credit union. I said, why would I have done that? And they went, oh, yeah, you probably wouldn't have done that. Okay, we'll take it off. So, wow. I mean, I saved $100 and I spent 40,000 hours in 28 years balancing my checkbook, and I decided I was done, so I stopped. Just whatever they say, it's right.
Sounds like a much better plan.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun. I hated doing it.
Have you been watching the news lately with the banks all being untrustworthy and generally evil and spawn of Satan and resulting in the end of the world at all?
I've heard that mentioned. But if you keep reading closely, they always say, accept credit unions.
Oh, okay.
Like a lot of the stuff, they are saying that the investment problems and the liquidity problems and everything, they're saying, yeah, but not the credit unions.
Oh. I must open me one of those.
I don't understand what that means, but that's what they say, so I'm happy. Well, let's see. We've covered security, RAW versus JPEG, why Bart is usually wrong, and a little bit of finances. Is that enough for this week, boys?
I think so. I unfortunately have I have a dinner appointment to go to. I get to be fed by someone else.
There you go. Well, Robert, I really want to thank you for coming on. Anytime you want to come on the show, this is a lot of fun.
It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I wish I knew as much as Bart, though, man. My computer would run so good.
If you forget that I know nothing about anything else.
Hey, you know? I don't know.
So,
you know, they try to make computers simple to run, but everybody you know has problems with their computer.
So do I.
Uh-oh, that's
everyone
not,
does.
You know what, though? That's one of the things I love about just life in general, and so many people don't get this, is it's okay that I know a bunch of stuff about the computer and somebody else knows a lot about gardening. I always find people in other topics, they're always saying, well, you shouldn't play around with your computer so much. You know, you shouldn't do that. You should care about this. And it's like, no. What makes this really work well is I know about this and you know about that. And if we talk to each other, then we know more. If I just have to give up what I know and only know what you know, then that's not very interesting.
Yeah, I guess, good point.
I just know a little about everything, so I don't know if that's good or bad.
Jack of all trades, master of none, huh?
Exactly. Now you're talking.
All right, so people can find you over at photographyandthemac.com, and I think your Twitter name is Photo and Mac?
That is correct, and they can also just check out my other photographs, and you can see every one of them was shot with JPEG, so you can decide. That's just at robertwachman.com. You can see that, or you can link to it from my Photography and the Mac site.
All right, cool. I'll put a link in the show notes to that, too. Thanks for coming, Robert.
I enjoyed it.
All right, Bart, we will talk to you next week.
I believe so. I'm not aware of any plans. I don't have a very interesting life, after all. So, until next week, happy computing.
Well, that was certainly an all-star cast. We had Bart and Robert and BJ and Bruce and Paul and Melissa and Lucian. We had quite a cast here tonight, and I had a lot of fun. And I want to give thanks out to everybody who joined me in the chat room, especially Maurice, correcting my error or my lack of understanding of how to use Resize Me. So if you'd like to come be part of the show and join us over on Ustream, check it out right now. It's on GMT-7 at 5 o'clock for like 2 weeks. Well, I guess it'll stay GMT-7. The rest of you guys will catch up to us, and then we'll get out of sync for a couple weeks, then we'll come back. But anyway, GMT-7 at 5 p.m. on Sunday nights is when we do the recording, so come on in and join us. You can also, of course, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet, but most importantly, send me emails at allison@podfeet.com. I just love to hear your dumb questions, those questions that you think nobody else has, but I'm guaranteed that somebody else has your same question. But keep them easy. Don't make them hard. I like the easy ones, okay? You can also send in praise, complaints. I may or may not listen to the complaints. We'll see, but I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.